You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Hea he mari e, tēnā koutou katoa, ko nea toka ingoa.
Ko Sophia toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. How are you today, Maya?
I am good, how are you?
I'm good, it's the last week of the semester,
Oh my god, is it?
Yeah,
oh, I didn't
nearly
realize.
Free.
Oh, nearly so free. Close. I'm out of uni, so I'm like so not in the loop.
Not looped, but we're so close.
Oh, so close from being out of the trenches.
Yep. Bright future ahead of me.
Bright future.
Maya, what have we got on the show today?
Yeah, I caught up with artist Adrienne Vaughan about her current show at Anna Miles Gallery, Blue Myrtle. So what have you got?
I caught up with Erica Holm, Naroma Riley and Tara Kasabul about their respective work in this year's Chartwell Trust's new commissions exhibition at Artspace Aotearoa, Echo.
He aha o whakara, would love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tuku patahi mai, you can text us on 5395-5355. Wai mai rane, or give us a call in the studio on 309-3879.
Also, after the show, koa e ware ware e ahea na koutou, te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō hei pakihere rukiruki maronga I te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
What's it all for?
Various Artists.
Echo is this year's Chartwell Trust new commissions exhibition at Artspace Aotearoa, showing new work by Tāmaki-based emerging artists Erica Holm, Naroma Riley and Tara Kasabul. Guided throughout the year by the mentorship of senior artists Judy Dara, Nova Paul and Anushka Eckel, the artists investigate mythology and storytelling through painting and sculpture, positioning these practices as critical sites for examining multiplicity and the complexity of existence. This week, I spoke to Erica, Naroma, and Tarika about their respective works in the show and their experience of this mentorship program. Erica Holm is a Tāmaki-based sculptural artist whose work often explores these ideas of desire and memory, interspersing adornments of femininity and bodily matter with wood and metal materiality. Her new sculptural installation in Echo, Apology, is a site of exchange and ritual, whereby viewers are invited to sit facing each other on these high bench seats with bronze cast feet, intersecting the space between them, enclosed in four framing posts adorned with human hair and wool, and a miniature bed below. Here is that kōrero with Erica now.
I'm an artist. I'm usually based in sort of sculpture and installation stuff. I work mainly between sort of wood, metal, and kind of bodily materials like hair. Quite often. I've got sort of a background in furniture making and I work as a technician at AET. So a lot of my practice is really influenced by furniture making ideas and using hard materials like that. Sort of some of the concepts I'm looking at is a lot of stuff around the body and domestic and things like that.
For Echo, this year's Chartwell Trust's new commissions exhibition at Artspace Aotearoa, you've worked with the mentorship of Judy Dara to produce this new work, Apology. Before we get to talking a bit more about the work itself, are you able to speak to this mentorship with Judy and the working relationship you developed together? What did that process look like and how did her mentorship alter or challenge your typical approach to making?
Working with Judy was amazing. It's like changed my life. Having Judy. I hope we're friends forever after this. So yeah, I think like some of the main things that Judy helped me with is just like, I think she really helped me take a lot of my ideas seriously and like kind of like, I remember one of the first meetings we had, I was showing her like the two wooden phalluses that I was making for an installation in Wellington, and she was like, just took it completely at like face value, was just like, okay, yeah, this is looking really strong here, like, and just like she had no sort of reaction and kind of like made me think very like differently about, you know, like things being reactionary or like feeling like anything that was a bit crass was like kind of going to incite like a specific kind of reaction in someone, which really was really nice and has helped me a lot with kind of taking myself more seriously. Yeah, and also just having, like, Judy in the workshop with me and, like, how we would just have, like, the whiteboard up and we would be drawing out, like, tiny little details of the sculpture and she would just be standing there with me, like, almost felt like a design meeting or something where, like, we kept on drawing over the same details being, like, no, we need to resolve this, And having someone there with me do that has been, like, incredible, because I know how she is so detail-oriented herself, that she knows that it's so important to, like, get, you know, the join of something or, like, the colour of something perfectly right on these, like, large-scale works. So, yeah, it was really lovely doing all that stuff.
Yeah, that's so special and so validating too, to have that kind of response to your work from her and continue that relationship. For the show, you've produced this really thoughtful work titled Apology, which creates a site for exchange and ritual. In this work, the viewer can be enclosed by these four framing posts adorned with human hair and wool and a miniature bed as they are invited to sit facing each other on these high bench seats with broadcast feet intersecting the space between them. Talk to me a little bit about your thought process behind this work. How do you kind of see each of these elements forming a cohesive idea within this sculptural installation?
Yeah, the kind of central bit of that work, the two cast bronze feet, was sort of the starting point of it. And I was thinking a lot about that kind of that feeling of, like, you know, when apologizing with someone, how when you're in a relationship with them or living with them or something, you end up kind of not being able to really ever apologize with any kind of, like, retrospect. And you're always doing it really, really close to them. And there's all these ideas of, like, intimacy and how interlocked you are in the first place. So I was just really wanting to think about, like, the idea of an apology existing within this, like, two people being so interlocked with one another that they can barely distinguish one from each other. And that kind of grew into thinking about, you know, the seats that people would sit on in the installation. And I started to think about, you know, this apologetic exchange kind of happening within, like, a nest sort of thing. And, like, the nest idea, I think I've read it in, like, a Louise Bourgeois book or something, but she always talks about how, like, birds make their nest with their own saliva and how they like to sort of felt natural materials into their nest that they're making. And I was thinking about, like, you know, when I'm apologizing to you within this home, that the home is sort of made up of, like, us, and, like, I'm in here with you and the walls are made of you. And that was, yeah, the kind of nest sort of hair wall idea, that hair is all made up of just the people in my life in the last few years. I've been collecting my hair for a long time. And I guess, yeah, the lower section of it, the miniature bed, is sort of like, it's sort of like a souvenir of the domestic home, you know, like the miniature bed, the perfectly made little bed is like, it's our perfect house together at the bottom.
That's such a beautiful thought process. And yeah, it's so nice to hear how each of those elements have, yeah, so much consideration behind them. And yeah, it's such a beautiful work. And I think that invitation for viewers to engage with it so personally is really special as well.
Yeah, I really love that, you know, like, just seeing people at the opening putting their hands into it. I mean, it was so special to see that, especially as they see it more and more now. I'm thinking, like, I really hope, well, my intention with it was kind of like, people can sit down and have whatever sort of feelings they want to have within it. It's not necessarily like an apologetic one or whatever. It's just the idea of sitting across from someone and being within something together. And whatever that kind of incites within those people is because of their own relationship.
How do you kind of see the work sitting within the wider context of the show, I guess, alongside Tarika and Ngaroma's work, and also in general with Art Space Aotearoa's annual question, is language large enough?
I think that just, like, going to that room and seeing it all together, I thought that the works worked together amazingly. I think that the scale that everyone worked at was so, I think that that kind of thing really works well in that gallery, is like having really large works together. And yeah, seeing all of the different works at scale together, I think made the show feel so grand, which was a really special thing to be a part of. Yeah, and the annual question. Yeah, I think it's that, for me, what I have been talking about for the last couple of weeks is, like, the idea of, you know, like, a kind of mute physical object actually being able to communicate something, and thinking about all of these, like, you know, human bodily objects that all usually have such intense meaning associated with them, all in these positions that are all really, like, invite you in and kind of almost asking you to, you know, put your hands in the seat or something. So yeah, I think I'm thinking a lot about the kind of the silent communication of these little bodily objects and the language of them.
That was artist Erica Holmes speaking to me about her work in Echo, this year's Chartwell Trust new commissions exhibition at Artspace Aotearoa. I also had a korero with Ngaroma Riley about her work in the show. Riley is an artist of Te Rarawa, Te Aupouri and Pākehā descent whose practice as a carver sees her bringing together whakapapa, Māori creation stories and popular culture in her sculptural installations. For Echo, Riley's Tihei Moriora sees a carved tekoteko standing over a metal surgery cum workshop table, pouring out a beam of light and Māori through a hand drill to the figure below. Here is that korero with Ngaroma now. Just to start our korero today, would you like to start by introducing your practice, the mediums you work with, and the key interests that underpin your art making?
Kia ora. The materials that I work in are wood. I'm generally scavenging, so I'll work with any kind of wood that I can get my hands on. Generally log, so that means taking the log, debarking it, cracking it open, seeing what it's like on the inside. I start with a korero with a story and then go from there. So I have an idea and then I find a material that would work size-wise, shape-wise. And the key interests that underpin my work, they're generally Māori narratives, but from a wahine Māori lens, I guess. For this particular work, for the work for this show, I've drawn on multiple points of reference, fused a few different korero together, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. You've worked with the mentorship of Nova Paul to produce this new work, Tihei Moriora. Are you able to speak to this mentorship with Nova and the working relationship you developed together? What did that process look like and how did her mentorship alter or challenge maybe your typical approach to making?
Yeah, that was great because Nova's not a carver, which I quite like because it brings a different perspective for sure. She's a wahine Māori artist, so there was, I guess, sometimes if I'm trying to explain what my work is about, there's a certain amount of code switching depending on the audience and what their background knowledge might be. It was great not having to explain myself to Nova for any of that. She really got it. But when she came in, she kind of said, oh, well, you know, I can't mentor you. You already know what you're doing, sort of thing. But, yeah, she was great. And it's always wonderful to have a soundboard and someone who will just question you, I guess, about your whakaaro and where you're going with your work. If you have any doubts about it or if they are unsure of the message, they want to clarify a few things, then they can throw that back at you, and Nova certainly did that. There did come a stage where I really wanted her to tell me what to do. Sometimes you think, oh, you know, I don't know. I had a couple of ideas, and so I was throwing them around, and I said, oh, you know, I've got this one or I've got that one. What do you think? And she said, well, you know, I shouldn't be telling you what to do at all. That's got to come from you, and no one should be telling you that sort of thing. And so I said, oh, okay, well, I'm going to go with this one then. And at that point, she said, no, don't do that one. Do the other one. Yeah, that was great. It was good fun. We had a lot of korero kind of off, nothing to do with the project korero, which is always great as well, a good relief. But then a lot of stuff around it all, and she certainly helped me tweak a few things from a Te Ao Māori perspective, which I really appreciated. Yeah, it was good fun.
Yeah, I really like what you said there about like not having to explain yourself to someone and the difference that makes. That's really gorgeous.
Yeah.
And so important in those kind of working relationships. I want to talk a little bit more about the work you've made for the show specifically, Tihei Moriora. You've created this carved tekoteko standing over a small figure laying on a metal surgery workshop table holding a hand drill, which, fitting to the title of the work, is pouring out this beam of light into the figure's heart and permeating it with Māori and a breath of life. Talk to me a little bit about your thought process behind this work. What do these elements collectively mean in combination with each other to you?
The work is really a creation story, and I've drawn on, starting I guess with Tāne Mahuta creating the first woman, Te Iro Wahine, from, Papatūānuku before her, but creating the first human woman from clay that he got from Kurawaka. But I kind of flipped it on its head a bit. There was a point, I kind of wanted to make them both genderless, which is what I often do because I started out carving bodhisattva, which are genderless. So that's what I wanted to do. And then at some point I kind of thought, oh, you know, I'm actually sick of this story about men, because I was also drawing on Victor Frankenstein creating his monster as well, and Geppetto with Pinocchio. And then I kind of thought, well, you know, we are the mothers, the birthers. And then for me as a wahine carver, there was a point where I kind of thought, well, you know, women are the punamato danga, and known to be the punamato danga knowledge holders. So I kind of flipped it on its head a bit and decided, well, actually this large teko teko is female, and she's hine ahu one creating her pepi or incubating, but this could also be not necessarily a mother, but a creator. And when you're creating, you're basically infusing Modi into your creation, and also passing on knowledge. So the unseen threads of the work is the aho going from the large teko teko to their tupuna, especially for me, I guess, because I'm largely self-taught, so it's very much a tupuna-led practice. So we have the aho coming from our tupuna to the creator, and then the creator is passing this on through their creation. And then you can also see that, again, is going into the pepi, and the pepi is going to be passing that on to their descendants. Those are kind of the unseen threads, and it's a continuum of all of that. I've used the beam of light because I'm a huge sci-fi fan.
I was thinking it's a little Star Wars-esque.
Oh, totally a lightsaber.
Great.
Yeah, because it just helps, you know, it's a visual cue. Yeah, and it's a nod to all my Star Wars fans out there, all the other fellow Star Wars fans.
Yeah, I love that. How do you kind of see the work sitting within the wider context of the show, with mythology being this binding theme between your own, Erica and Tarika's works in the space? Or I guess, how do you see the work sitting within Art Space Aotearoa's annual question, is language large enough?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know what the others were going to make for the show. I'm familiar with their practices, but I didn't know. I only knew through the curator, Robbie Hancock, little snippets of what they were doing and how they were going with their journey. So it all came together incredibly well. And when Tarika was talking about, was giving a brief kōrero, was kind of the practice run for the press brief, and I thought, oh, far out, that should be my kōrero. You know, it was really very kind of similar, and I thought, oh yeah, no, that's really neat. And it was interesting, like all the colours kind of fit together very well as well. Erica, I was worried about her seeing my work because she's got such a fine eye for details, and her work's always so slick, really well finished. Yeah, it's really beautiful. So I guess particularly with Whakaero Māori, there's so much. With colonisation, of course, you know, we lost Whakaero in the north, particularly where I'm from. My grandfather, my tupu, was 100% Māori, but he was an Anglican minister, and he went to a native school up north. The missionary influence was huge up there. There were pros and cons, I guess, of it. But Whakaero was one of the big things that we lost as a result of all of that. So it's a language that hasn't been completely lost, but was lost for a while, and certainly aspects of it have been lost. So Henry Anō Te Reo, is language large enough? There are so many different type of languages, including, you know, Whakaero, which is a visual language, but it's going to be reinterpreted and have been reinterpreted, of course, because of a lot of the mātauranga that we've lost around it. And because I don't have the usual access to a lot of wānanga, being a wahine Māori, again, how I acquire that knowledge is different from how, say, a tāne might. And again, a lot of it's tupuna-led. Yeah, creating, tapping into different modes of learning different languages and then creating your own, I guess. The whole experience was amazing. It was my first time carving on such a large scale. So that was really exciting, physically really challenging. Like I kind of measured everything up got the wood that I needed, didn't think about the weight of the wood when I got it. So thankfully I had a great friend, Tui Hobson, who's a Cook Island carver, an amazing carver, who helped me get this massive log back to the studio. Yeah, and that was a whole new challenge in itself, just working with this massive log and the fear of death by log, I guess, it all worked out well. And to have the amazing support of Chartwell Trust in order to do this, and Artspace Aotearoa, the team there, particularly shout out to Robbie Hancock, the curator, who is amazing, and the mentorship that we received from him as well was really supportive.
Yeah, of course, shout out. That was artist Ngaroma Riley speaking to me about her work in ECHO, this year's Chartwell Trust new commissions exhibition at Artspace Aotearoa. Lastly, I spoke with Tarika Sabawal about her work in the show. Sabawal is a Tamaki-based artist whose materially led practice in painting sees her exploring the ways to narrativize personal relationships and landscapes within a South Asian mythological framework. For ECHO, she has produced two new paintings titled The Rush and Offbeat, whereby she is building on her interest in imagery taken from classical Hindu folklore and further exploring the subject of the horse and the figure, depicting her own partner as the central protagonist, challenging traditional values and notions of femininity, strength and power. Here is the interview now.
I'm Tarika Sabawal, and I'm an artist based in Tamaki Makaurau. I predominantly use an airbrush, and I paint onto either raw canvas or, in this instance, in the show, I painted onto calico. And a bit about my practice is I'm very materially driven, so I'm always trying to find a push and a pull between control and the lack of. So I'm like allowing for accidental moments and then problem solving around them. Yeah, but for this show, I really wanted to rely less on my airbrush and kind of lean more into mark making to show more movement within the work, and just broader themes that I think about. I try to place my personal narratives within a Hindu mythological framework. And for me, it's like a way to reject or resist dominant patriarchal narratives that are formalized within my South Asian community.
Yeah, beautiful. For ECHO, you've worked with the mentorship of Anushka Akal to produce these two new paintings. Before we get into talking a bit more about the works themselves, are you able to speak a bit to this mentorship with Anushka and the working relationship you developed together? What did that process look like, and how did her mentorship maybe alter or challenge your typical approach to making?
Yeah, I mean, this mentorship program was such a generous experience. I think it was such a privilege to be working with an artist of her caliber. And yeah, just like working with an artist with such a critical eye, but also she was so considered in the way that she would deliver feedback and have so much care for me and my practice. It was really, really amazing to work with her, and just an absolute pleasure. Some of the things that we kind of like talked about were sort of repetition. She kind of saw that I was working quite a bit in repetition and kind of like urged me to lean into that repetition, which was kind of fun. But I took her advice a bit too literally, because she'd say, make everything three times. But yeah.
I do want to talk a little bit more about the works that you have produced for the show. You've produced these two new large-scale paintings whereby a band of horses, a recurring subject of your practice, appears in both. In The Rush, these horses are seen as if they are carrying a floating figure downstream, whereas in Offbeat, the figure stands with the horses surrounding her. Talk to me a bit about the imagery within these works. What was the kind of thinking behind those depictions?
Yeah, so the pictorial reference for these works is from the Agni Pariksha, where the story goes where a woman is kidnapped and she's rescued by her husband and taken back to the town, where the town members kind of question her loyalty to her husband, which is pretty random to be kidnapped and then questioned. So I kind of wanted to just play with that idea of, yeah, this being sentenced this into like a trial by fire. So I've painted actually my partner being carried down like a wave of blind running horses, and then like cornered by the horses in the flame as well. And she's kind of having some kind of a performance and marching in an offbeat manner, sort of ambivalent in a way.
These works do feel like kind of an extension on your previous work, and maybe going a little bit further with a larger scale, or they feel a little bit more pencil heavy than previous work as well. What were some of those changes and shifts that you made in producing these works, and what was that experience like?
Yeah, I think I was noticing that I was just having way too much control in my practice, and I really wanted to create like a shift. So going large scale and then taking away that control, like being too close to the canvas, I started creating like these tools and sticking markers onto like massive sticks so that I could like step away and use my whole body to create movement. Yeah, because I was painting from sculptures, so I think that's maybe where the stagnation was coming from. And I think, yeah, just freeing up, not using that much masking, maybe playing a bit more with the bleeding and allowing more for accidental, happy accidents.
As you kind of mentioned at the beginning there, mythology is and storytelling is a big part of your practice, and it was kind of a binding theme or site for analysis in this exhibition. How do you kind of see the work sitting within the wider context of the show and Artspace Aotearoa's annual question, is language large enough?
Yeah, I kind of see this this show as like a reflection of storytelling shifting and changing through each teller. So language, visual language, oral language, all shaped depending on who is the narrator. And I'm really interested in who accesses these different versions and who's included, who's excluded, and what do we tacitly learn from these decisions.
That was artist Tarika Sabawal speaking to me about her work in Echo, this year's Chartwell Trust new commissions exhibition at Artspace Aotearoa. You can see Sabawal's work alongside Erica Holmes and Naroma Riley's at Artspace Aotearoa until the 20th of December.
Yes, darling, but is it art?
You're listening to Various Artists. We'll be right back.
Whoa, I've never seen so many colours come out of someone's mouth before.
There's more where that came from.
The Exploding Rainbow Orchestra is back. And if you want to see all the colours of the rainbow in one room erupting in wondrous sonic performance, then tune into 95BFM Drive all week, because we've got tickets to give away to the opening night.
The Exploding Rainbow Songbook Volume 4, November 4th, 5th and 6th at Whakamana Cannabis Museum. Tickets available from Mushtix.
You know how everyone has a day one? Like day one at uni, day one of your first job.
Yeah, why?
Well, these filmmakers, they're having their day one. Day one shorts. 8 films from local directors getting their first big break.
What kind of stories?
All sorts. Fertility, ballroom, sweaty hands, even a corporate monster crash out.
Sounds like a bit of me.
All free to watch on YouTube, RNZ and Multi Plus.
I'm checking them out tonight.
Day one shorts. New voices, bold stories. Stream now.
Do you growl towards the weekend on a Friday afternoon like the cockroach that hides in the corner of your room and crawls towards your sleeping face at night to slither inside your ear and lay its eggs?
Well, it's lucky we have this show to jolt you awake and stop all that disgusting crawling.
It's the Friday 2 to 4 with a brain-birthing cast of DJs ready to get you hyped for the weekend.
West Coast, chopping.
Regan, wake up.
West Coast.
Honey,
onshore.
You're having those strange nightmares. Oh, no, it's not.
1 out of 10 on both coasts.
Oh, God. Father Damien, it's happening again.
Looking for tubular swells? It's the 95BFM Surf Report. Is the West Coast gnarly? Is the East Coast bogus? Do people even still use these words? Find out every morning on Breakfast and every afternoon on Drive. The Totally Radical Surf Report, proudly brought to you by the dudes and dudettes at ProGear.
Thank you.
good art.
Adrienne Vaughan is a Tamaki-based painter driven by her boundless fascination and exploration of her mediums, in which she produces beautiful abstract paintings that employ an enriched vocabulary of colour, line, shape and form, and brings them into a world of her own. Forms themselves hover in a space of peculiarity, hinting to a kind of still life with a touch of surrealism, embodying a mysterious cast of characters. Her current exhibition at Anna Miles Gallery, Blue Myrtle, showcases a shift in Vaughan's painting practice, a slowing down of sorts to allow for a new sense of intimacy with the painted surface, a softening and more tender approach to her use of pattern making within the canvas, letting the paint's inherent materiality and its trace of application linger on the painting surface, creating its own sense of pattern making within the painted image. I had a corridor with Adrienne Vaughan about the show and overall practice. Would you like to start off by introducing yourself and your overall practice a little bit?
Hello, my name is Adrienne Vaughan. I'm a painter based in Auckland. I studied at Unitech many years ago and I've continued working, and I paint sort of strange, sort of abstract things and landscapes of such. Yeah.
Your current show on at Anna Miles Gallery, Blue Myrtle, showcases a beautiful body of paintings that span the gallery walls with their soft gelato-like colour palette. This exhibition sees a kind of shift in your practice, a softening and more tender display of your use of pattern making within the canvas. What influenced this shift going into this project?
I think I just wanted to slow things down and have a bit more awareness about the way in which the paint was applied. I felt like, you know, patterns are quite jumpy, they're quite fast, quite frenetic, and I just wanted to just take a breath and really get absorbed in the paint surface. I felt like I'd sort of lost touch with the experience of really looking and observing and really seeing without the weight of what I'd done before. I wanted a bit more sensitivity in the paint handling, exploring colour harmonies and brush marks, edges, slowing down the decision making also was a big part of it.
Yeah, so this kind of shift away from that more, yeah, heavy pattern making opened up that application of paint and for the colour to really shine within the works.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, and through this tender approach to pattern making, you've already kind of talked about it, but there seems to be more of an exploration of the paint's own materiality, its own inherent qualities, focusing in on these small gestures within the blocks of colour, letting the imprint of the brush to kind of take on that pattern-like quality. Was that something that you thought about, that gesture of that brush taking on that pattern making?
Yes, it was sort of, whereas before I'd be creating patterns, and this time it felt more like the brush was just the brushiness of brushing on paint and the different qualities that you would get, the different, you know, layers and textures. That was the pattern in itself this time around, more rather than trying to make a pattern. With mark making, you know.
And did you discover kind of, like a new language within the paint through this process of really focusing in on it?
I don't know. I think just slowing right down and just, you know, seeing what happens when you paint up to an edge and then you've got another colour underneath and you just paint up to the edge and you've got a little bit showing through and just really subtle changes like that.
And in the past, your practice has also encompassed drawing, utilising ink and collage, producing these wonderful drawings on paper. And even with these current works, which are oil on canvas, they still seem to hold this drawing-like sensibility. How does that history with collage and ink and drawing translate to these works on, like, oil on canvas?
Well, funny enough, I didn't... I kind of changed the practice this time around and I didn't do what I usually do, which is start out with a whole lot of drawings with, you know, like you just said, ink, collage, etc. I had a lot of canvases prepared and I just decided to just go straight in and start painting. And I did smaller drawings sort of in tandem, just sort of quick sketches to give me information, and they were really fun. because I've always had a kind of tension between the drawing and the painting, and having drawing is sort of a slippery kind of relationship between the two. There was always freedom on paper, but I found it difficult to translate that to canvas, so I kind of had to kind of tweak that a little bit. So that was where the different approach came in.
Yeah. Do you find that that history with working with paper, that it brings something different to the canvas?
I don't know. I know that I did, my canvases were, I made them A3 size, so they're almost exactly the same size as my drawings. It's kind of a trick to get myself going, you know, because obviously scale becomes into play here. You know, you're used to making marks on a certain scale, and to kind of ease into it, I thought I would keep it at the same size.
So you head straight into your paintings without that pre-drawing. So you kind of, head into the painting without knowing kind of what's going to arise on the canvas?
Yes, absolutely. I think what interests me is that real mixture of what you know and what you don't know, and the element of surprise, the mysterious qualities that you can never plan for. Yeah,
and kind of letting the paint and the materiality and responding to that paint carry the work.
Yeah, letting it unfold slowly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you all painters sort of have their own sort of self-imposed parameters of inquiry that they, you know, set up. And then it's about a mixture of that knowledge that you've had in the past and an awareness of what's happening now. And that's where those elements come in of you know, I wasn't expecting that sort of thing, you know.
And I wanted to speak a little bit about the particular compositions and forms within the works themselves that kind of hint to a still life-like arrangement of objects within the surrealism-like undercurrent. Where do these forms and compositions arise from within your work, or kind of reference in a way?
Well, I've always been interested in sort of the figure field relationships, so that alongside the pattern, but I want to sort of push them and pull them around and unbalance them and have things tilting and balancing and, you know, blow up sort of forms, distort them, fragment them. You know, there's a lot of mileage to be had there. I think it's sort of endless. And not every now and then sort of strange figurative shapes show up in the work and, you know, you just go with that. And that's probably where the surrealist element comes in. Kind of that tension between what's abstract and what's going into more figurative or...
Yeah, and I've also noticed within your work there's this kind of reoccurring utilization of a horizon line of sorts, or like a play on the horizon line in juxtaposition to these forms and soft pattern use. What do you want to speak a bit more about this, these pairings of these forms and these kind of objects, like with that horizon line?
I guess that's just sort of exploring pictorial space in a painting. Just, you know, depth, shallowness, you know, where the image sits. Does it tuck under something? Is something folded over something else? Does something disappear down into something else? All those things are quite interesting, and they do have, they have effects. So that's probably, a horizon line is, and it's also a way to anchor something, you know. So
yeah, it's really wonderful. Yeah, they do kind of act as this anchoring or grounding of sorts within this world of the painting. What are your hopes for viewers as they engage with the works and enter into the gallery?
I don't really have any... I'm not concerned with what people see in my work. You know, if you can get a particular feeling from it or a sensation, then, you know, that's nice. I don't really... I'm not trying to, you know, guide the viewer to anything. You know, I think we've built an image of what painting is, you know. Oh, that's a painting of apples, or that's an abstract painting, or that's gestural. We kind of categorise things. But I kind of, you know, just hope that you really look, just looking and observing, you know.
That was Adrienne Fawn speaking to me about her current exhibition at Anna Miles Gallery, Blue Myrtle, which is on until the 6th of November.
Various artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
God. We'll be right back with your arts guy, but in the meantime, here's some Arthur Russell.
Yeah. It's the 95 BFM Art Guide on various artists.
It's paintings in that.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tāmaki Makaurau. As mentioned on the show, Echo, an exhibition by Tarika Sabuol, Erica Holm and Naroma Riley is on at Artspace Aotearoa until the 20th of December.
Also mentioned on the show, Blue Myrtle by Adrian Vaughan is on at Anna Miles Gallery until the 6th of November.
Extension by Aiko Olakin opens tonight at Straw House Gallery from 6 till 8 p.m.
Room has two new exhibitions which opened on Wednesday night, Stack Rat by Finn Chadwick, Marilyn Jones and Bronte Heron, and also Prelude by Tess Walker-Elliott. Both are on until the 29th of November.
Still Growing Up by Gavin Hurley is on at Melanie Roger Gallery until the 1st of November.
New paintings by Liz Moore and Erica Holmes' Eunuch are on at Ivan Anthony Gallery until the 8th of November.
Hiria Anderson Mita's Pā Te Huarahi Ki Te Kāinga, Finding My Way Home, is on at Tim Melville Gallery until the 15th of November.
Matthew Galloway's Watch History is on at Suma until the 15th of November.
Louise Bourgeois in Private View is on at Auckland Art Gallery Toyo Tāmaki. And Gus Fisher Gallery's group exhibition, What We Choose to Remember, as well as Chevron Hassett's Aroha Ki Te Tangata, is on until the 13th of December. If you have something you want on the Art Guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for us on Various Artists for today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us.
Erica Holm, Naroma Riley and Tarika Sabawal.
And Adrian Vaughan.
Nei rā, hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95BFM.com or check out our Instagram at 95BFM Various Artists for more.
Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. Next up is the land of the good groove. My name is Sophia.
I'm Maya.
And that was Various Artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95BFM.
Bye.
Keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.